Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am, as ever, your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, you were ill last week, but I'm very glad to see you back on your feet. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here. Cold day, though.
Indeed it is. Winter is properly here with us. And, of course, we also have Sargon, who has apologized ahead of time for the, as you can probably hear right now, the chainsaws going wild in the background. Sara, welcome.
And then, thank you. And they're not my chainsaws. I have no control over them.
Indeed. But, you know, we do the best we can. We have to deal with the many trials and tribulations of suburbia in South Africa. All right. So our first story for today is a story we talked about on Thursday. It had only just come out then, and there's been an entire weekend full of commentary and a couple new revelations, I guess, or at least details about this story. And we are, of course, talking about President Cyril Ramaphosa, the accusations against President Cyril Ramaphosa that he was involved in covering up the theft of $4 million from his farm, that he never reported this to the police. And so former state security agency head Arthur Fraser, who then went on to lead the correctional services and was responsible for approving Jacob Zuma's medical parole, has laid criminal charges against the president. And it's been quite interesting. I saw Amu Bugane, who are the sort of big corruption-busting journalistic team out there, got a very high profile for delving into corruption allegations. They posted some details about this at length, about how that's connected to something going on in Namibia, and it all sounds, I think, a bit strange. When we initially saw this story on Thursday, I can't remember precisely what we said, but we were a little bit suspicious of any accusations made by Arthur Fraser, considering he is such a partisan figure. But it's come out over the weekend that there might in fact be something there. Cyril Ramaphosa seems to have, rather than dismissing these as sort of just complete nonsense, has, I think, been a little bit defensive about this. He said on Twitter, "Some are casting aspersions about me and money. I want to assure you, comrades, that all this money was from proceeds from selling animals. I have never stolen money from anywhere, be it from our taxpayers, be it from anyone." His team also went on to say that the people making these allegations have, quote, their own political agenda and are well aware of that. It will not deter me from fighting corruption. So, Sara, let's start with you. What do you make of this? Do you think I'm reading too much into it by saying that the president was a little bit defensive in responding to some of these allegations?
No, I agree with you. I think the tone was defensive. And I also thought the first utterances when this came up included a sort of, well, you know, we did a satisfied with the investigation, and I informed my protection unit, and they had a charge, or they informed the police or something. It was very defensive. It was very wishy-washy. It gave the sense that there's a whole process that if either was not followed or half followed, and it's just the nature of the allegations. There are two things. The one is that $4 million, if you convert it, is about 60 million rand. So it's not little money. That's the one thing. The other thing is, where in the hell would he have kept it in the house? That, you know, if the domestic tipped off people, which is very, you know, that's a very common way of home theft happening. And also the fact that amount of dollars is, as far as I know, you know, the Reserve Bank doesn't.
Right, there could very well be sort of foreign exchange
issues, which of course could mean that Cyril gets affected by effectively the Al Capone method of getting rid of the senior person. Whether it's the Namibian angle, I've not seen much about, but that suggests there may be something more unpleasant about it. But I think what one must not underestimate is what we spoke about earlier, and that is that Arthur Fraser's a very canny operator. He knows his stuff. He's not a clown in the secret services. He's a very sharp operate in a very, he's a tough guy. And I think one has to be very careful, because I very much doubt that someone like Fraser would have gone and done this on a whim or sort of with half-cocked evidence. So it is intriguing. And obviously, if it negatively affects Cyril's reputation, that would be very bad for the ANC, because there would be no glue left.
Exactly. Also, I just don't fully understand why, you know, if this is theft, he might be trying to cover it up, particularly when it seems to be sort of from him or from his business. Anyway, it's a strange story. And I'm sure the more and more evidence will come out as it goes into the public square. You know, as for the political hit aspect of this, this is very obviously a political hit in the lead up to the ANC's elective conference in December of this year. But just because of political hit doesn't mean it's necessarily untrue. So I think it's become increasingly clear that we at least have to take this seriously. So there was a lot of commentary over the weekend about this. Some people expressing big concern for Ramaphosa, saying, oh, this looks bad for him. And other people saying that this was terrible. And in fact, maybe we even need to rally more around Ramaphosa than ever before. Justice Malala didn't say that quite, but he did say that if Cyril Ramaphosa goes down due to these allegations, that it will be the return of the state capture crowd and we'll be back where we were in the mid-2010s. An interesting question that. Terence, what do you make of some of the politics of this? Do you think that if Cyril goes, then the Zumarites will be back in control and then everything will be terrible? Or do you think things will be much the same? What do you make of all this?
Well, it's a complicated question. I mean, I think that one of the smoking guns about the political hit aspect is that this is alleged to have happened in 2020. That's a long time ago. to have sat on evidence of wrongdoing does not inspire probity in the person leading the charge. Inspire confidence in the probity of the person leading the charge, not inspire probity. That might be too much. An ANC without Ramaphosa, I think becomes an organization rather like the story in of the Philistines temple in the Samson story in the Bible, where, you know, the pillars get knocked out and the whole show comes crumbling down. I don't think there's anyone who could really step into that role. I think that there are people who might have their eyes on the office, but I don't think they have either the charisma, the organizational ability, the credibility to hold that. Look, I would say this: never say that things can't get any worse for anyone who's going to cackle about this. So South Africa has shown that things can get worse. You know, sometimes they can get significantly worse when you thought, you know, our politics is testimony to the way things just get more and more ridiculous.
Just on that point, if anyone ever says things can't get worse, there is a country called South Sudan. And I think they're about the only people on earth who could possibly say that things can't possibly get worse.
Yeah, you know, you say that now. What I would comment, though, is that an ANC heading towards what looks like a lost majority in the foreseeable future, and I think without Cyril Ramaphosa, that becomes a much more imminent thing, is likely to be an ANC headed by people who will have a grab what they can mentality. So good things get worse under these conditions? I think so, yes.
So I think that's exactly right. The political consequences of this, I think, are quite big. If it turns out, as this kind of is interrogated by the public eye, that people come away from this with the perception that Cyril Ramaphosa is not, as he's been mockingly called by us, among others, Saint Cyril. And in fact, he is at least a little bit compromised. Maybe he's not as compromised as the Zumarite faction. And I'm sure that, firstly, there won't be criminal, he's not going to be going to jail. I'm also sure that he's not going to lose at the elective conference. But I do think that this could be a very powerful crack in his armor. Because once the argument for Cyril becomes, well, he's not actually that great, but he's better than X, it loses some of its sheen. And Ramaphosa, which has been with us since his election to the head of the ANC, has been fading, I think, everywhere. And this seems to me like it might be the death blow for it. Sara, final thoughts?
Yeah, I think that if any shine goes off him and it in any way affects the results for the ANC in the elections, the very idea of sort of the wild dog pack of coalition parties becomes much more enticing and much more realistic. And I suppose things not getting worse or getting worse, South Africa sometimes benefits from the absolutely unexpected. So who knows?
No, I think that's definitely true. We said this on Thursday, I think, but it's worth saying again, Cyril is by far the most popular politician in the country. And a lot of ANC supporters at the moment seem to be saying they support the ANC because of Cyril. So if he loses some of that popularity, I think the ANC is in even deeper trouble than it already is in. Anyway, let's move on to our next story. So we're going overseas for this one, and this is leading into a wider debate about the role of sort of social media and the laws governing it in societies across the world. So an Australian court has ordered that Google needs to pay a former lawmaker $500,000, which is $715,000, because it refused to remove a YouTuber's, quote, relentless, racist, vilificatory, abusive and defamatory videos that drove this politician out of politics. The court found that the company which owns Google, which is Alphabet Incorporated, intentionally made money by hosting two videos on its YouTube website attacking the then Deputy Premier of New South Wales. And these videos have been seen something like 800,000 times since being posted in 2020. So basically, this follows in the heels of a ruling a while ago where a newspaper was found liable for comments made, I think, on its Facebook page, not by anyone who works at the newspaper, but on its Facebook page underneath an article that had been posted. And this has caused a big freak out among social media companies who, let's be honest, as much as they try and put in place draconian systems to sort of control and regulate content on their platforms, they really actually don't control them that well. And a lot of them are now saying that they're just going to reduce their presence as much as possible in Australia because they do not want to be sued out of existence. This is not only an Australian thing. I know that in the US there's been a lot of calls from both left and right on the political spectrum, although for very different reasons, to take away some of the legal protections that social media companies have there. So making Twitter liable, for example, for its moderation decisions and for the content posted there. Some say it's a way to increase freedom of speech by ensuring that these companies can't censor people for political views, and others because they want the companies to crack down on hate speech on their platforms and get in trouble if they don't do that in a draconian enough fashion. So it really seems like there's a sort of, I'm not going to call it a consensus, but an emerging bloc that really wants to make social media liable for anything that's said on social media platforms, which would completely undermine, I think, the way that the internet has been run up till now. Terence, what do you make of this? Would that be a good thing?
I don't know whether it would. It's one of these conundra. On the one hand, I very consciously am not on Twitter because it's a cesspool. I don't think it's conducive to debate. It's encouraged a kind of discourse in which everything is about sarcasm, snappy put downs. On the other hand, you know, there was a report recently by the American NGO Freedom House about transnational repression, and one of the techniques that authoritarian governments use to get at people abroad, you know, exiles, dissidents, and whatever, is cyber harassment. And this is often done through social media channels. I don't know how one strikes the balance. My intuition, my inclination, is to go the route of freedom rather than the route of security. But the hopes that were vested in the internet, 20 years ago, this was going to tear down, every Chinese wall, to lightly quote Karl Marx, has been replaced with erecting Chinese firewalls. Law has long recognized the principles of libel and slander and that sort of thing. The question though is whether the mediating agency, the technology company, can and should be held responsible. I think we can hold a sort of moral blameworthiness towards companies that allow poor behavior. But just in a practical sense, is it even possible? Can anyone monitor every comment made on YouTube or on Twitter or anything like that? This is something that I think that people far more intelligent than I will have to wrestle with, and probably for a long time.
So, I kind of see both sides of this, but I must say I think that it's a terrible idea to punish social media companies for what gets posted on their websites, because this is sort of core to the internet, and we can't really undo this now because the internet's been built in a certain way. I think that the result of this has actually been profoundly negative. That the fear of the social media companies not necessarily being held legally responsible for things, but at least morally responsible, has actually driven a lot of draconian enforcement systems. So, like, for example, on YouTube here, if we say certain things, our video will get taken down. Now, mostly those things are things that most people would agree are pretty bad, sort of like, calls for violence, stuff like that. But some of the things are kind of much more debatable as to whether we can, discuss them or not, or whether it's legitimate to discuss them or not on a sort of platform. And a lot of YouTube content creators complain about this, but it's not just YouTube, it's everywhere pretty much, that moderation seems biased, irrational, unfair. Yeah. And that's just because this thing there's too much info. Algorithms haven't been able to do it. If you hire people, they're probably not able to do it, just because the volume of tweets and videos and messages and posts is just too much. Sara, what do you make of all this?
Look, I think the broadest free speech possible is the only way these entities can operate. I mean, as you say, it becomes a kind of what you pick and choose. But however, I have a little problem with defamation. I mean, defamation, long-standing civil action. Obviously, in the past, it was letters being written. Then it was emails, and people were held to have committed defamation of email correspondence. That's no different to Twitter. And I think if somebody reports to Twitter that things are being said, I mean, I can call somebody by horrible names, but I'm not necessarily making a false allegation that could ruin their lives. And I think that's a different. And I think if I think that they shouldn't try to monitor everything, but if a complaint is made, they need to look at what's being complained at and say, is this defamatory, as opposed to simply being rude or aggressive.
So in this particular case, I believe that it was reported to Google, and their internal processes said it's fine.
Yeah. Well, you see, the problem, and of course the problem with Twitter, and I kind of really agree with Terence on this, is you can't sue the person. You should be suing the person who made the comments, but you can't find the person. You don't know who the person is. They have a pseudonym or whatever it is, maybe.
69 said this about you. Wow, the drums on my beat.
Whiskey Jack said, eh? Are you up? That's the problem. Unless the Google system can obtain that information and say that they will release it if prima facie it's defamation, so that the person can sue them and not the, but then they have to bring it down, because if they're going to, even if they get to sue the person, it'd be very unwise for Google to keep it up. I don't think, I don't know, maybe wrong, but I think that's more manageable than trying to sort of manage the moral or political content of anything.
So what's kind of interesting here is I think that's part of the problem is that a lot of this happens across borders as well, right? So even if you know who the person is, you trying to sue someone for defamation in another country who does different set of libel laws, it doesn't really quite work in the same way. So I think it's a puzzle.
It's not easy. I mean, it really is not easy. But the problem is, and I've been involved way back in a couple of defamation cases, and I'm actually seeing it happen. I'm seeing it happen now in respect to teachers being harassed at schools in terms of the ethos of promoting critical race theory. It is devastating. It is absolutely devastating. The guilty, you know, guilty before you've proven innocent sort of scenario. So it's a very ugly thing. It's a very, very personally ugly thing.
And definitely. Anyway, this is certainly some. Go ahead,
Dan. Just just picking up on Sora's reference to our friend Whiskey Jack. You know, I think he makes an excellent point that discourse has been the biggest victim. I think absolutely. I wrote a piece in the Daily Friend about this about sort of two weeks ago, about what, you know, Musk or no Musk. Twitter's not where you're going to have a proper debate. Structure. It's just the medium is not suitable for it. You know, and I think. In an ideal world, perhaps what we should be trying to promote is more respectful and polite and open-minded dialogue. There was an article in the Daily Maverick where someone was talking about the Stellenbosch case and said, well, you know, because systematic racism is real, he will believe until it's proven otherwise that this is a racist incident. You know, already, you know, so we start with a conclusion and then we work from there rather than saying, well, there are an infinite number of explanations for why this disgraceful incident happened, of which one may be racism. But and let's, you know, try and establish the facts. We are living, I think, often in tribal or ideological bubbles, and it's not good for a pluralistic democracy.
Hmm. All right, let's move on to our last story for today.
Thank you.
Let's
ask things about me sometimes.
People are allowed to not like you. They're not allowed to say that you've done something you haven't done, like, you know, done things with little boys,
set fire to a school or something. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so let's move on to our last story. And this is something, you know, we've seen quite a lot of, I think, over the recent years is terrorist attacks on terrorist attacks or attacks by sort of mentally ill people on places of worship around the world. So I know in the US there was a shooting in a synagogue recently. I know in Pakistan there have been Shiite mosques, Afghanistan, there have been Shiite mosques that have been blown up by ISIS there. And of course, we've also seen shootings in churches. The most recent of which, I'm forgetting, of course, the awful shooting in the Christchurch Mosque in New Zealand by a white supremacist. And now we've seen a shooting of 50 people in what has been called a vile and satanic attack on a Nigerian Catholic church. Gunmen murdered dozens of congregants during mass at a Catholic church in Ondo State, Nigeria, on Sunday. The attackers used explosives and firearms in the attack on St. Francis Xavier Catholic Church, killing more than 50, according to reports. Apparently, the priest was also taken hostage and has disappeared. He's still not been found. It was called vile and satanic by the governor of the state, whose name I'm not going to try to pronounce. As far as we know, no terror group has actually claimed responsibility for this, but I'm sure one will in not too distant future. It's probably Boko Haram or one of the sort of ISIS affiliates in that part of the world. A distressing situation, but Terence, you had some thoughts on the way that the media looks at a story like this in Nigeria. Would you like to expound on those?
Well, it's not just the media. I think it's the sort of whole thought universe, if you like, and especially the thought universe who are, you know, people who are like us, comfortable, you know, media savvy, etc. I remember when the shooting in New Zealand happened. I mean, people's hashtags were lighting up with, you know, I stand by New Zealand, and there was outpouring of sympathy, all, you know, richly deserved, and that was sort of given up to the minute coverage. Now here you have something equivalent, you know, virtually, you know, seems to be almost exactly the same, except we don't know the precise motivation. But, you know, 50 people gunned down while celebrating Mass on Pentecost. That's a serious incident. There was an attack on a church and a Sunday school in Sri Lanka also some time ago. It got very, very little attention. There's been attacks in the Philippines. Some might say, well, you know, this is about bias against Christians. There may be some truth to that. Certainly, a lot of Christian communities live under a state of oppression, which is I think is scandalously unacknowledged. China, for instance. But I think this is also about the fact that, you know, when it happens in a developed country where, you know, we have relatives living, or we, you know, aspire to go on holiday, you know, that shakes us. You know, shooting up the frozen yogurt booth is something that we can identify with. When it's a dusty backwater in a place we can't pronounce, where people speak funny languages and, you know, just look very different or whatever, it's a statistic. It's a filler article. You know, and I think, you know, that's a kind of prejudice, I think, that is not unique to any particular ideology or to any particular race or social group. It's about kind of being able to identify with some and not by others. But I think what really sort of twists this is that something like the Christchurch mosque shooting was held up by a number of people I know as you know, a clarion call for moral action. You know, if you're not outraged about this, if you're not protesting, if you're not making yourself heard, this is an indictment on you morally. Something like this can happen, and, you know, it's almost like a tree falling in a jungle. It's very, very sad, and I think, you know, calls for some introspection, perhaps.
Sorry, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think the amount of persecution of Christians in North African and Middle Eastern countries, it is considerable. You know, harassing,
yes,
raping, burning churches down, killing people, and I think it happens way much more than we know. And I think it's that sort of simple mainstream media thing of, if it happens in the first world, it gets attention because it's unusual. But one attributes sort of, well, this kind of thing kind of happens in the developing world, and, you know, it just becomes numbers. What I'm concerned about, I don't know very much about the workings of the various church groups, but is one doesn't see action and condemnation publicly from the church, the church at the very top, whether it be Anglican or Catholic. And I mean, to my mind, it doesn't matter what denomination you are, but but Christian churches should be standing up. And to my mind, you've got the Anglican church becoming the wokest institution in the UK, which is quite a, you know, quite a high bar. And it's just that's what amazes me, is that you don't get a really outraged response from essentially the entities at the top who are responsible for their flock, if I can put it that way. It's just, the silence is terrifying. I mean, the way the Yazidis were treated in the Syrian war by ISIS was absolutely beyond horrific, and we knew about it, but it somehow didn't seem to sort of burn the ire in the breast of the guys at the top.
Mm-hmm. And I think some of that is also because Most people didn't know who the Yazidis were until they were basically being genocided.
Look, you know, I can answer Sora's question to an extent. In some respects, it's because a lot of churches which have, let's say, a Western or a European heritage, not all churches do. The Ethiopian Orthodox Church, for instance, they have absorbed a lot of the cultural currents that have gone through the West in the last 50 years. In some respects, these institutions are post-Christian. And it's almost difficult for some senior clerics who have very little supernatural faith themselves to kind of put themselves, you know, why is someone willing to die or kill for a faith? You know, so it becomes about, well, this is about poverty or whatever, which, you know, in a place like Nigeria, that's definitely part of it. But, you know, it doesn't deal with the whole problem. Secondly, there is a tradition in Christianity that, you know, almost views persecution as attacks of the faith. I mean, that, and there is no, Christianity does not have the sort of international faith community that exists to an extent amongst Muslims. You know, they have the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. When there's a cartoon in Denmark, the Egyptian ambassador will complain. You're much more likely to see the Vatican or the Archbishop of Canterbury or the German Evangelical Bishops Conference, you know, saying we need to dialogue, we need to talk. There's also, sadly, a romanticism about others, and this, you know, during the communist period, this was very, very damaging to a lot of Christians who lived under oppressive regimes, because the communists could talk the right game on poverty. In fact, the World Council of Churches, you made a kind of half-hearted apology. Well, we never supported groups like Solidarity or Charter 77 because we didn't realize how serious the problem was. Well, yeah, the Vatican, and I'm a Roman Catholic myself, not the world's best one, so you know, please don't take me as your starting point. The agreement with the Chinese Communist Party is absolutely shameful. From what I can establish, and as far as I can establish, the text has never been released. But it's worse than the one they concluded with the Nazis. That one said, you know, we'll keep out of each other's lane. This one says, well, you know, we'll kind of give the Chinese have veto powers. And the character of the Communist Party of China was known before, and they carried on doing exactly what they were doing. And just 2 weeks ago, also a story that's a surprising little coverage, Cardinal Zen of China, probably the most senior cleric in that part of the world, was arrested.
Yeah, in Hong Kong as well, which is even worse. All right, unfortunately, we are out of time, so we hope you found this episode interesting. Please leave us a like, please subscribe to us, and we will see you tomorrow on The Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone.